take a moment to connect in the invisible, but in the net which goes around the globe, where we as a conscious family coming together, caring for how we evolve, caring for how we treat each other, how we treat our beautiful planet, and just take a moment to sense that we are strongly connected, that we in every corner on this planet, someone lives who really cares deeply about, and yeah, so just feel it. And today I want to really warmly welcome Warren Brush to the Conscious Evolution Summit. And Warren is a internationally renowned permaculture designer. Warren, you travel all over the world. You share your knowledge and your love with private people, with communities, with organizations and networks, and in the Global Eco Village Network, I believe. And I'm curious really to hear from you, because you are really out there all over the planet and connecting with people, and really hear from you what you see from your perspective is really crucial to know and to bring our attention to, in order to really use the crisis we are in as a birth in something new, and where we use the momentum to create a world of beauty and of love where we all want to live in.
I am so with you there, and thank you, Puria, for having me a part of this conversation, because it's such an important conversation that people need to be having right now around appreciating the world we live in and our heart connection to one another and to the landscapes that sustain us, and also to be thinking about where we are in the state of the world at this very unique time in history. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Maybe you start sharing where your passion just goes right now in your life.
Okay. Wow, that's a big question, Furia, to ask about passion. So much of my life right now is involved in working with different communities around the world to be in an honorable relationship with that which sustains them, where they're feeding and doing life-giving work on the ground to help the ways they sustain them to be a part of the ecologies that they live in, not being separate from it. And so that's a lot of the work around the permaculture work that I do. And yet I find permaculture is a movement that is a vehicle for my deeper heart work, that it allows me to go and have these conversations that are much, much more than just a design science to stabilize our food systems and our waste systems and our energy systems, and to design in a way that is really efficient. That's the conversations at the surface of how do we live equitably in the land. And where it goes oftentimes, and where my heart and my passion is about working with grief and working with our understanding that you know, grief is a beautiful part of a natural human being's life, because what it means is that there's some point in our journey that we lose something we love. And it may be that it's a family member, it may be that it's a you know, there are thousands of things in our lives that we lose. That's a part of this beautiful cycle of life and death. And it may be, in these days especially, it may be a forest that you love is starting to be cut down. It may be, you know, whatever that is in our hearts, that there's this natural process that I actually believe is at the core of why we damage landscapes, has to do with how we move grief within us. And for me, that's the bigger conversation, is how can we turn and metabolize the grief in our life that is a natural part of being a human and being alive and loving the world? How can that transform into something life-giving in its next iteration? Mm-hmm. How can it break down its component parts and become the nutrient for the next garden of life in your life? And I really believe a lot of where the world is right now has to do with our loss as societies and villages to be able to actually move grief in a life-giving way. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about permaculture, there's that part that's, you know, I'm here at a conference in Washington, D.C. right now, working with some of the largest non-government organizations in the world through USAID, and we're talking about resilience design and working in communities that are refugee communities, humanitarian communities, and I realize, like, there's such a need for that landscape design and the social system design, but really it goes back to that place of how are we moving grief, both from our own lives and from our ancestral griefs that carry and transfer from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, when you ask about passion, that's really at the core and the essence.
Mm. And I'm curious, how did you realize that there is this connection of grief and how we are with it, how we process it or not, and how we treat our environment or our landscape? How does it start that you saw this connection?
You know, one, I have really good teachers in my life, elders in my life, who have shared a lot from their experiences and their cultural contexts. And I also have experienced my own grief in life and knowing, you know, I believe that if we truly lose something we love, which is a natural part of life, because there's that cycling that happens and when we lose something we love, we have this churning that happens inside of us that has to be expressed in a healthy way. And cultures all over the world have elaborate grief ritual that have been a part of their history as long as they've been intact as a culture. In fact, a lot of cultures are now starting to lose this. But when I see something happen globally, in isolated villages and they talk about grief and how it moves and the importance of it, I know it's innately human and it's important to pay attention to it. And especially coming from a society that has lost a lot of, its umbilical is not in the ground any longer. Like, I don't have great-great-grandmothers who were on a landscape where I'm living who had great-great-grandmothers guiding them. And I don't have that. I didn't grow up in that circumstance. And so often what we have to do in modernity is to start to seed those roots of culture to grow again. Because I believe that culture is never lost. It's actually, it's still in the ground. It's actually our relationship to place that we become a vessel of culture of place based on our relationship to that place. And I feel like for me, this whole idea of grief is such a big part of, like, in America right now, there's, you know, we have the most depression in the world. If you look at studies that have been done in, you know, psychological studies that have been done around America, we have the most depressed society in the world, that there's more depression. We medicate more people per capita than any other place in the world. We have more children who are medicated than any other place in the world. And it tells me that there's this great unresolved grief, because I believe that if you don't move grief in a life-giving way, if it doesn't move in a ritualistic way, in a way that, you know, that is healthy and life-giving, where it's transformed into creativity and art and music and song and tears, and it's not transformed into that, then it becomes stuck inside you. And one of our teachers in our life, who speaks of the Tutuhil Mayan people, is they talk about grief that is stuck as their same word for cancer. So when grief is no longer moving an emotion, it becomes what they say is actually the physical manifestation of cancer. And interestingly enough, America has the highest levels of cancer per capita of any country in the world. And so it's this, to me, all these signs are pointing towards this unmoving grief. And that becomes, for me, a really important understanding, that then if grief no longer moves, then depression starts to take over. And when you have a depressed society, there's usually two major reactions. One is you repress the world around you. And I believe a lot of the ecological destruction that's going on around the world has to do with this repression that's rooted in grief that began with unmoving, that's rooted in depression that began with unmoving grief. And the other is self-inflicting. So you victimize yourself, is another expression of depression. And so that's right at the core of where I feel this work is.
And I mean, some also say that depression is the cancer of the soul.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. And so that brings us to this place of, what do we do to move that grief in a life-giving way? In the Mayan people, they say that if you have enough people who are depressed, it leads to warfare, or it leads to violence. And so when you look at the tracks of what's happening ecologically, and you look at the tracks of what's happening socially, especially coming out of places like America, you can see that depression has now moved to a mass violence. And it's a violence against nature. It's a violence against nature in ourselves. And it's America has been in war for so long now. It's like my parents' generation through my generation, we declare war every few years on something, on someone, somewhere, or on something internal in our society. And I feel like that, it's like we can protest war, which I think is important. I think we have to also speak out and protest violence in any of its forms. But I also believe we have to get to the root of things. And that's really important, is to go to the causes and not just fight the symptoms. And I see that all over the world, people are giving their energy to trying to do something to mitigate the symptoms of things, but not really going to the root. And so I feel it's really important that we share, like what you're doing with your Conscious Evolution Summit. It's about sharing things that get to the core, and about getting to the root of things, and then giving our hearts to that. And that's the part that's really important in this work, is that we follow our heart. And I tell students this all the time, and I, in my conversations with my friends or my dear love in my life, my sweet Cindy, who's my wife of nearly 30 years, that, this is we're in the time of the heart, and we're in the time of having to follow our heart, because if we go and try to address grief from a logical place, we'll end up in the whirlpool that surrounds grief. And we need to not go there. We need to be in a place where we can hold it and transform it.
Yeah, and basically I would even say trying to rationalize, analyze, looking for on a rational level even takes us away from really processing grief. So often we use that in order to not feel what we feel, because in my perspective, if I really open my heart and I really feel the grief, it's a kind of death I experience. I'm smashed into 1,000 pieces when I absolutely go there. But I think it's really necessary in order to kind of have that, then the material to compost all of that, if you would use a earthly language for it, and then that something new can build. And I'm really curious what you found out is on an individual level, and also coming together really supports this transforming it, integrating it, healing it.
Yeah, it's for me, there's the first thing I have to look at is, what am I carrying within me? How much of my ancestral grief, how much of that is affecting my daily decisions? Where is it? Where does it rest and reside in myself? Where is it? Because I know I come from a people who have long lost those rituals. My family has been in America for many years. They came back even from before that, from Scotland and from France and from different areas of Norway and that region. I have a lot of ancestry there, but as I start to track back some of the history of where I come from, I start to realize that there's a place where, even looking back at Scotland and France and some of the Norwegian areas, that there's actually places further back that I originate from that have, there's been a memory trauma. And for example, let me explain this a little bit, is that there is, in America, oftentimes you're asked to fill out, when you're filling out a form for the government, they'll ask you your race. And one of the things that they ask is, they'll say, oh, are you Asian descent, African descent? Are you, Latin America? Are you Caucasian? And so the Caucasian box is the one that I check, because usually what that means is that you're fair skinned and you come from a European descent, is how I've always thought of it. And I started to really think about, well, what does Caucasian actually mean? And what I realized is that it actually means the Caucasus Mountains, that this place in the Caucasus Mountains, which are much further east than many of the places I say I'm from, my family lineage is from. And I realized that there is this old traumas of somewhere back there in my history, somewhere back there, I'm sure in your history, I think in now, people pretty much around the globe have had this syndrome that has knocked their indigenous people off their root, their umbilical cord that connected them to a mountain and a place for generations and generations. This syndrome has knocked them off, and we have moved in flight westerly. We've gone in this westerly flight, and oftentimes we talk about the Western movement. I see it actually as this movement of a syndrome that we then flee, because we've, whatever it is that knocked us off, where our elders were killed, our midwives were killed, the storytellers were, we were told to go out of the out of the woods, we were not to live in this backwards way, and we moved in flight away from the trauma. We carry that original trauma with us. And all along the way, the rituals, the things that we knew in our umbilical excuse me, when our umbilical was in the ground, starts to be lost. We carry it for a while, but then the further we get away from the trauma, the more our memory blocks it out. And I think that checking of the Caucasian is a memory gap for many of us, that somewhere before or further east of the Caucasian mountain came from traumas where we lost our indigenosity. Hold on one sec.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's actually, that grief is coming out in my cough,
mm-hmm.
that it's still there, and it may take generations to move away from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that's something, the first thing in approaching it is looking at, wow, I carry this story of being pushed away from the mountains of my ancestors, where I was living, my indigenous soul had a home in a village, in a culture that was intact to a landscape.
Mm.
And I have a great grief over that. And I feel that now, especially being able to travel the world and be in conversations with communities around the world, that I feel that there's, you know, that great grief there within me, and it still is moving, and I keep it moving, and I weep for it. And so that's, for me, the first place. What do we carry? You know, and then I have my ancestors who, you know, who were people who killed people and people who loved people, like all of it mixed together. And some of that grief had moved in a healthy way. But in my spiritual ecology, that when grief isn't moved and you die, and it can become a ghost in the next generation. And then if that generation doesn't move that grief in a healthy, life-giving way, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger inside. And pretty soon these ghosts are jumping from one generation to the next. And they're, you know, some of our children right now and ourselves are carrying these great ancestral grief bundles, in addition to the grief that we carry in our own life for just being human and just loving life and losing those things we love. And so it's this weird amalgamation of that ancestral grief and our grief now that I think is the work that's at the core of what we do. And to heal landscapes means that we also have to begin with healing our internal landscape, and we have to start finding ways in our own life to give our indigenous soul a home.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess in the first place, this is what you just do in naming it, becoming aware of it, kind of really open ourselves to feel it, to maybe images are coming, maybe stories are coming. But what is your experience? How can we be, or is there anything to do in order to process it, really?
Mm. Yeah. Oh, beautiful question. Thank you for asking it. You know, I think of what comes to mind is, we know what to do. Somewhere inside of us is the memory of we know what to do. It's in our DNA. We know that this work has to happen within us and around us. And so what I look to is that our original birth story of each one of us has a birth story from our mothers. And we, you know, we lived this very sacred, holy life in our mother's belly, in the amniotic sea in our mother's belly. And we spiraled out as these little beings in our mother's belly. And as we developed in this place where there's no gravity, there's no gravity, you're floating in your mother's belly, you don't have to eat, you don't have to breathe, and you hear this rhythm that is your mother's heartbeat, just literally, that is the thing that you have pulsing through, is that, and I always call that the first rhythm. That's your first rhythm in life, and you pattern your whole life on your mother's rhythm, I believe, is a part of what you carry the rest of your life. And especially young men will start to seek that again as they become young men, as they start to seek those things that give them a memory of their mother's heartbeat. And I really feel that in that place is one of the most holy, sacred places, and the times of our life is when we're in that ocean. And then as we develop further in that 9-month journey in our mother's belly, another rhythm develops, which is our own heartbeat. And as a young baby in the belly, this sacred being, it's much faster. It's like a hummingbird heartbeat. It's like 10 times or 8 times the speed of your mother's heartbeat. And you have this syncopation. It's like our first jazz that happens in our mother's belly. And then we hit this place in the journey where often the case is that the amniotic fluid drains out. So all of a sudden you're in this world. Everything you know is in this world, and all of a sudden it drains out from you. And you no longer are surrounded. You feel the weight of the world when you're no longer in the amniotic fluid. And then you start to make this journey out, this very small tunnel into this brightness, that it's nothing. You've never had that kind of brightness. You've always had your mother, this, her lens of her belly is all you've ever seen. And all of a sudden you're moving in a very uncomfortable way through this passage out into this light. And you get out into this light, and there's people, and there's sounds, and there's light, and you can no longer, as you're moving away from your mother's heartbeat, the one thing you know is your mother's heartbeat, and you move away from it. And you come out, and you're separated from her, and you have to breathe your first breath. You feel the weight, you see the light, and you can no longer feel your mother's heartbeat. It no longer surrounds you. And that, to me, is our first grief. That is our very first grief we experience in this world. And it's natural. We've lost our mother's heartbeat. And, you know, and what do we do, Puria? What do we do as a baby? What's the first thing that happens when we experience that grief?
I mean, I think we scream the hell out of us. I lost my paradise.
Yeah, it's exactly it. We move it with our weeping. And if you have a really good midwife, she'll bring you and help you, guide you up your mother's belly back to her heartbeat, so you can feel her heartbeat again, and you get laid back on your mother's heartbeat, so you know it's going to be okay. But we know what to do with grief, and it's to move it through weeping. We have to weep for the world. We have to weep for those things that we've lost. We have to weep. And if we have nothing to weep for, it means we love nothing. And so it's really important for us to recognize that I believe grief is a muscle inside of us, that in one range of motion, it's this great sadness that we weep, that loss of our mother's heartbeat. It's the loss of the trees that we played in as children that were cut down to put a parking lot in. It's those losses in our lives that occur, and that's this natural thing. But that same muscle in another, the other opposite range of motion is joy. It's praise. The capacity for us to feel joy and to praise the world comes from our ability to express grief. It's like if you ever laugh so hard you cry, or you cry so hard you laugh, that's that muscle moving in different directions. Mm-hmm. And I find that is where the work is for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what yeah. I just received images while I was listening to you is, because I'm really interested, how can we support each other in processing that? And the image I received is while you're weeping, or you're weeping and then some person just embraces you, you feel the love of another person, you hear the heartbeat as you described, as you had with your mother, then you kind of, you really move between this weeping and experiencing the love and weeping and love, and that both polarities, the joy and the loss, is really kind of in our spectrum.
It's there's so much in that. I think it's when we it's like this, what I believe so much, like tears are an offering to the world. Like that's my belief and my wife's belief, and our teachers have shared that with us. Actually, many of our teachers share a very similar understanding around this, that our tears are an offering. And yet so often we are, our religion, a lot of religions talk about that, you know, we don't weep because we have God's grace, or we have like this idea that we know we don't need to weep for the world. And I really feel strongly that it's the part that allows and opens up this idea of being a person in the world that makes offerings. That we are people, and our offerings and our grief can become the great offerings that give life, that they become art, they become music, they become those creative expressions that literally the grief is at the genesis of deep and authentic creativity. And so as I start to think about that, that one of the ways to move grief is that initial layer is the weeping, and it's the hugs, and it's the rituals in our villages that allow us to weep together. So it might be a wedding, it might be a funeral, it might be whatever the ritual is. One of our teachers would talk about in their village that at the end of a great feast where everybody's so excited that they all start weeping together with no prompt other than they just start weeping, and they say that's the dessert. That's the dessert that the holy feeds upon. Mm-hmm. And that our tears become a gift to the holy, and that the holy is what gives us life, so that we have food in our life, that we have shelter, that we have this beautiful world around us is actually being fed by our offerings. And then it in return feeds us with everything that's around us. And so this idea that our tears, like we can take a tear from our eye and we can give it to a tree that we love, we can put it on the earth, we can share our tears as offerings is something that I, for some reason, that makes so much sense to me, because it moves that grief, and it also is, it doesn't allow it to become depression. Mm-hmm. And so what I find is when you have like a Presbyterian culture, and I'm just saying, cause that's a background that I had, with growing up, is that there was this huge emphasis on not weeping. And not that tears were actually not something that I was to share and experience. It was something that from a lot of the writings within that religion, that they're saying that you don't weep when someone dies. And it's like, I found that I had to go through a lot of weeping in my life to move away from that. And I had to go through a lot of my own expressions of that. And so if I step back from that story, so that began from that question of yours of what is my passion and where am I putting my energy in the world, is that I start to see then that unexpressed grief becomes inside of us, then becomes an external expression of repression and violence potentially, or self-inflicted victimization and self-inflicted wounds. And so the work that I'm doing in permaculture is about healing the landscape that surrounds us and the landscape that's within us. And so the platform of permaculture for me allows for the conversation to talk about healing. Mm-hmm. Because people will ask, how do I create, how does this landscape, how can it be more productive? How could it be? And it's about healing a damaged landscape and then recognizing that we also have a damaged landscape that needs healing. And I think of those, you know, it's like you were sharing your journey to, you know, being in India and with Amma, and so much of our seeking in the world is about healing those wounds that we carry both from our own life and from our ancestral life. And in some cultures, there's still a lot of ritual around that. So the music that happens, the meditation that happens with through Amma's work is part of moving that grief and helping it have a home and actually composting it, like you're saying, so that life can come out of that compost, a new garden can be grown, that and this incredible expression of art can start to be a part of healing the world, that art is not this thing that's for us, that it's not for us as people, I believe. I believe that true art is actually what feeds the holy in the world. Mm. It actually is what feed and moves grief in such a deep and profound way. And so it's not about us just entertaining ourselves. It's about this deep art being an expression of that grief now metabolizing and becoming something beautiful in the world. And that beauty then feeds us as well. And so that's part of that cycle of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I also want to kind of address again, what you already mentioned a few sentences ago, that basically the wisdom and the knowledge resides really within us. But in order to kind of become aware what intelligence just is in us, we often just need to make space of it, make our life a bit slower, step out of our immense activities, take some hours, some days just being with us and exploring what is already there. Because I just want to share briefly, I had a few years ago, I had a very strong impulse to sit for some days and nights just in the darkness without light, just on my own. And what happened there was that for some days I would just in my imagination, in, as you said it, in my inner landscape, I would see myself on different places on the earth where I haven't been in this life physically. But I saw myself just there connecting with the land, with the nature there, sometimes with people. And I don't know exactly on a rational level what it was about, but it felt like kind of recollecting parts of myself or of wisdom or of story, just bringing it back into this life, into this body. And this felt just kind of like, I don't know, like bringing back pieces in a library also, different ways to interpret it. But yeah, I just want to kind of encourage people also to follow their impulses and really to be open to what wisdom is just there.
I am so, yeah, thank you for that story and that that image of you sitting in the dark and seeing these, you know, it's like being carried to these different places that, you know, maybe it's these memory places and deep memory. And I really feel like this idea of remembering, re-membering, that we have to put the world back together, our world back together as part of that healing. And a lot of it has to do with our memory and how do we remember the things in our life? How do we, you know, I greeting a friend in New Zealand who's from the old people of New Zealand. And when you put your forehead together with them, as part of their greeting and you share a breath, one of the things that struck me is that they recite 20 generations of their family lineage. And I was thinking about that for myself and how, and so many people I know in the modern world, there's not an ability to even understand, like, or know or remember people in your own line more than a few generations. And I was really struck by that understanding of, like, memory and remembering what's there. And then for me, it's like I can go so far back in my research of my ancestry, and I hit these walls where I can't get beyond it. And so I have to go to those dark places and start to ask for those memories so that I can start to move those memories, because I think they sit there in us, and it takes us slowing down. And I feel a lot of the modern world, the movement and the speed in which we move is a distraction to actually going to those places of memory, those deep memory places that we distract ourselves with, our the importance of movement, of the things we're doing right now. And I agree with you that it's so much, it's not about doing more in the world right now for healing. It's not about doing more. It's actually about, I believe, going into the cave, going into the darkness so that something new can grow out of that. And our memories can start to hydrate back through time so that we can move grief that's been in our ancestral lines, so that your daughter, my daughter, and our, you know, I have a grandchild as well, a granddaughter, that they don't have to carry that grief. That they, it's like it stops with us. And anybody who's listening, that's our work in the world, is to not let it go to that next generation, and to empower the next generation to be people who weep for the world and create beauty and create, to create life-giving aspects around them. So to be a part of what's life-giving, not what's life-taking. And it goes back to, I think, that part of, like, really being fully present, but also having a memory as far back as you can muster in your life. And I also feel that there's a piece of that that allows your gifts as a human being, that, like, Puria, I believe that you have some gifts that the world has never seen before in all the history of humanity. They've never seen the gifts that you're bringing into the world. In all the future of humanity, no one will be able to express the gifts that you carry right at this moment. And that's for myself, and that's for every single person, that there's something that you have that the world needs to be whole. And that our roles as community members, as other humans sharing this journey of being a human, is to help each other express those gifts so that we're all more whole. And I think there's some relationship between the memory piece of understanding where you've been to uncovering and discovering, nurturing those gifts that we have inside of us, that allows us to then start to take the next best step forward to being a life-giving force in the world. Mm.
Yeah, and what also comes to my mind when I listen to you, Warren, is that really turning the center where our power is, really, it's inward. I mean, the world outside there, advertisement and mainstream education and news, they tell us that all what is needed is out there, and we need this and we need that. But to turn it around and to kind of not believing in that anymore, because we all see the kind of the results of believing in that. So really turning towards our innate power, our wisdom, our memories, as you said, and especially as role models for children, really, yeah, modeling that, giving them that this experience while they grow up, where really the real beauty, the real power, the real value is. This, I think, is so important.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a belief that I have that has it's been recently reinforced by a lot of research of how our worldviews are formed. And there are two major influences that form our worldview, and our worldview drives our actions in the world. And so how our worldview forms is a really important understanding of how we change worldviews so that the actions that are occurring in the world are life-giving. And it's really two main influences that form a worldview. And that is sensory input. So all the things that come to our senses, whatever that is. So, you know, I'm in this hotel room in Washington, D.C., because I'm here doing a talk at a conference. And I'm this land or this room is very diminished compared to being in a forest. Like there's less patterns happening. This is a very simplified, there's a lot of right angles, there's a lot of flat surface, not what you find in nature. I'm having this experience where what is being my sensory input is actually not as diverse as it would be in let's say the forest or even a park out here in the city. And so I have this input coming in, and it can come in so many different ways. Like, you know, I think part of your story of going into the darkness has to do with like allowing our sensory input system to reset. You know, it's like every creation story in the world begins in the nothingness and the darkness, every creation story, and then a word or a sound. Through sound, life comes out, and so of that darkness. So I feel like there's this part of the sensory input that there's this notion of like you can go and you can reset it, but then what do you surround yourself with? Are you spending enough time in nature so that you have this diverse and very, you know, it's like the old trees are elders who are in their gifts. Literally, the birds are in their gifts. The coyotes and the foxes are in their gifts. Are you surrounding yourselves and myself with input from beings being in their gift? So that becomes an important thing of thinking of children that I'm working with and people that I'm working with. What is their sensory input? Are they sitting in an office cubicle getting this very diminished input that's altered nature, that it's like, you know, there's just less diversity happening? And is their worldview becoming less diverse because that's what's coming in? So thinking about that, how are you spending your time? What are the inputs into your senses? Are you eating food that's vibrant and alive and has nutrient in it? Or are you, you know, going to the mass produced, industrial produced where foods have been, you know, have basically through forms of warfare, literally the chemicals that are being used are warfare chemicals and derived from warfare chemicals that came out of World War II. Are you deriving that input from warfare and from devastation and from, you know, that process? Or are you putting food that's alive and that's been grown with songs and with love and with healthy nutrients and with an integrated ecology? And, you know, every piece, what are you listening to? What are you, you know, are you hearing the dawn chorus of birds in the morning? Are you, as you make your prayers to the sun, are you, you know, what are the sounds that you're doing? Or are you in the honking horns and the traffic each day? And that is affecting our input of our worldview. And the way we see the world comes from how our senses perceive the world. And then there's this other influence, which is what we give our attention to. Where do we give our attention? Are we focusing on gratitude? Are we focusing on, you know, the sounds of the birds singing to the sun in the morning? Are we giving our attention, or are we giving our attention to the advertising billboards and the news? You know, it's like we have cell phones now and people have news flashing up all the time. And you think of what is being shown to us through that mode of communication is just constant fear, constant fear. We live in a world of fear. And the more you're in a state of fear, the more your sensory apparatus, and this is a well-known ecological factor, biological fact, is that in a state of fear, your sensory apparatus starts to shut down, and you actually don't see the world as it is in a state of fear. And it also elevates your stress levels, which then you need more calories to, you know, consume to feed the stress, and then all of the health all of the health issues that come out of that. And so being conscious about what are you giving your attention to? Are you going and are you singing with people at the ashram? Are you listening to someone intently? Are you present with them and really hearing them? Are you steeped in the sounds of the ocean crashing on the shore? Are you finding places in your life where you give space for that to reboot your system so your worldview can hold a life-giving purpose? It can hold biodiversity. It can hold diversity of ways of looking at the world. And it allows you to more be present in that journey for me to be present by the way I give my attention. And so I think you're so right with that. It's like we're bombarded with so many sensory inputs that aren't life-giving. We're bombarded with toxicities. We're bombarded with, you know, the news and the stories of basically the expression of grief in our landscape. And so, you know, I meet people all the time who are very sensitive to the world. I mean, your daughter is one too. Your daughter is very sensitive, I think. She has a deep sensitivity that Laura does. And I feel that especially now there's a lot of our children that are born with extra sensitivity, and that they are a part of what will lead many people into the healing of the grief that has to move in the world for healing to take place. And I really feel like a lot of young people are being born with extra sensitivities because they know it has to change. We have so much shifting that has to have happen right now. And there was just a report that came out Monday from the Intergovernment Panel on Biodiversity and Ecological Services that was saying in the next 20 years, we're basically going to lose 1 million species in the world. It was one of the most ominous reports ecologically. And I think about like my daughter and my granddaughter, and that they're inheriting this. Your daughter is inheriting this great loss of biodiversity, and what can we do to help prepare them for a world that is so different than even today? How can we help them? And I feel like it's equipping them with really good pathways to use their heart to heal what they can in their landscapes, what surrounds them, that they pull in from this world that's so globalized, to being able to be in relationship with what sustains them and to do it in an honorable way. And I think if it boils down, or if we distill it all down, to me, that is such an important path forward. That is like, we have to be in relationship with what sustains us in a way that's honorable. And the way where if I take the life of a plant to eat that plant, that I can give a tear in exchange for the debt that I'm taking from the world. Or if I'm eating chicken or whatever people's diets are, or if I'm, you know, building a house that I'm the trees that are being taken, that I'm in a relationship with those trees, that ideally that is where we start to anchor our umbilical cord in the world is through that honorable relationship with that which sustains us. And so as I come all the way back around to permaculture, permaculture is a design science to help us rebuild that relationship with that which sustains us. And for me, so as we talk about it, there's these many deeper layers of that, but that ultimately it's about being in this honorable relationship in the world. And yeah, that's how I'm seeing it these days and feeling it in my heart.
I thank you so much, Warren, too. So you really shared so honestly and authentic with us your passion. What is your passion in your heart? And I really enjoyed very much listening to your experience, to your wisdom, to what you care about. And I deeply believe that many of the listeners now might become more curious also about you, your work, and also about permaculture in general. And I will offer your website URL. And is there anything what you have now in mind? Because the summit might be launched at the end of September, October. Do you already know of events which might take place in this time frame?
So thank you for asking that. And on my website, permaculture.us, I post my events that I have scheduled. And I every year I do a permaculture design course every end of October, beginning of November at a place called Quail Springs. And their website is Quail Springs, so like the bird, springs.org. And there is a permaculture design course there that we do every year. We've been doing it for many, many years. And this is a place that my wife and I were some of the co-founders of this community there. And we, you know, I encourage people to join us there if they're really interested in that. I also, you can contact me through the website as well if you have some insights you'd like to share with me. A lot of the work I'm doing is working globally. I do about 6 trips to Africa a year. I was just Malia, I'll just be going to Uganda and Ethiopia, be going to Benin and Congo, and then I teach every summer in France. And so every summer I teach at Amma's Ashram there in collaboration with Colibri, which is this you know, very powerful, I shouldn't say power, it's powerful from a heartful place, environmental organization in France. And so those are a few things that are a part of my life now that I would love to, you know, meet you there at one of those places. And but I think if anything is just to really ask yourself, how is it that what is my relationship to that which sustains me, and what can I do to enhance that, coupled with what are my gifts that the world needs, that the world's asking for, and that those two things, when they come together, I believe that the healing that needs to take place will take place. I really believe that's the way forward. That's the answer to climate change. That's the answers to so much of the disparity in the world, are those two things of our relationship, which sustains us as honorable, and that we each step into our gifts and we live a vision of what the world wants for us, not necessarily what we want for the world, is to answer the call that the world is putting out for us now.
Thank you so much. What lovely words to end our conversation, our time together. Thank you so much for helping us to remember and for weaving the net with our ancestors and our deep love in our heart. And I value it so much, because I know it took some some tries that you find together. You are a busy man traveling around the world. Now you are in this conference. So I really appreciate that you took this time to share your wisdom with us here listening and watching this. Thank you, Warren.
Thank you. Thank you, Puria. And I appreciate your patience in all this. So in being able to stay with asking me to be a part of this. And it's been such an honor and so lovely to see your smile and to think of Laura. And yeah, it just is, it's a gift. It's a gift. So thank you.
Thank you.